I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do.
This is Bill Duncliffe. I want to welcome you back to another edition of the Can Do Horse Racing Podcast, where the heroes and history of horse racing come alive. The history of our sport is replete with epic tales of match races between heralded participants. Listeners to Can Do in Season 5 will remember we opened that season with a two-part interview of author Jennifer Kelly, whose book, Sir Barton and the Making of the Triple Crown, included the first Triple Crown champion's defeat in a match race versus the Mighty Man O' War at now long-gone Kenilworth Park in Ontario, Canada. Less remembered, for whatever reason, is the classic East versus West matchup of three-year-olds between the regally bred Nashua and the more humbly bred Swaps, a race that mirrored Sir Barton's defeat to Man O' War and that Swaps was also suffering from a foot ailment leading into his untimely date with racing history. But that defeat compared not in the least to the fate suffered by Nashua's owner William Woodward, who, a bare 2 months later, was shot to death by his wife, alleged, and I do mean alleged, to have mistaken her husband for a burglar. Memo to self. Make sure to announce one's presence loudly each time one enters a room in the family manse. Some, rightly so, consider the last half of the classic Preakness featuring Sunday Silence and Easy Goer to be the equivalent of a match race. To quote the classic Paul Ford character Mayor Shin in The Music Man, I will not say them nay! And of course, fondly recounted cinematically is the great match race between Seabiscuit and War Admiral at Pimlico, although for movie-making purposes, Keeneland Racecourse was repurposed as Old Hilltop. Less fondly remembered, of course, is the fateful match race between Kentucky Derby winner Foolish Pleasure and champion filly Ruffian, with the tragic results unfolding on national TV. But it's that match race and cinematic angle where our guests today come in. We first met Leon Nichols and Calvin Davis from the Project to Preserve African-American Turf History in Season 3 of our podcast, when we talked about their efforts to both honor some long-forgotten heroes of the turf and to educate the sporting and otherwise public about the contributions of legends like Isaac Murphy to the history of our sport in its earliest days before Jim Crow attitudes and discrimination reared its head. They are also the leaders behind Bet the World Entertainment, which has the goal of ultimately introducing a true world championship event to racing, world championships of horses, jockeys, and trainers, a Ryder Cup type event, if you will, except one focused on horse racing. Leon and Calvin, along with their partners Jerry Fife and Jim Natsis, have made it their mission to recall, recount, and celebrate the contributions of African Americans to the history of our sport. As you know, perhaps the most well-known legend of our sport they honor is Isaac Murphy, who also figures prominently in our match race story. But a little bit of history about Isaac first. Isaac, as you will hear, was not only one of the great sporting figures of the late 19th century, he was also one of the most idolized sporting figures of his day. Think of Babe Ruth, Tom Brady, Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan. He was that famous. Famous for his ability, famous for his accomplishments, famous for his integrity.
He was a very proud individual, and he was a very principled individual as well. One of the things that I read about him that I was fascinated by was that he was offered, Isaac Murphy we're talking about now, was offered huge bribes to let a horse named Falsetto lose the 1879 Kenner Stakes. And he refused to take them. He would not, and the money, as I understand, that was on the line was pretty significant. And to someone who came from, you know, modest circumstances, would have made quite a difference.
We always say uncompromising integrity. He was a man with strict honesty. I mean, his nickname was Honest Ike, but he also understood, you know, a very principled individual, a very articulate individual. He understood the fact that at that time, he was solely responsible for advancing the sport forward. Regardless of color, Isaac understood, because Isaac ran in circles of white wealth, of everyday men and women. I mean, he was beloved by everyone. I think there was quotes in the Spirit of the Times newspaper of the day where, you know, and again, let's put it in context. These were young white kids, you know, as we've seen in our generation, how kids adore Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods. But one of the stories in the Spirit of the Times where, you know, a young kid was asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the kid says, I want to be like Isaac Murphy, the great Isaac Murphy, you know, and it so that tells you, gives you, an entry point into his wide appeal and his honesty, and he was just someone to be revered and looked up to. He was really that first crossover talent, if you will. It was braced, you know, by everybody, black and white alike, adored this man, and so much so that the press loved him because he was always his openness and willingness to share stories and just to be accessible. Also, just you know, again, as you spoke about his integrity, his uncompromising integrity. I mean, there's several quotes in there. You know, I know one goes something like, you know, a man that will sell his soul for a penny to one man will do the same to another. And I think the principle was, if I was to take a bribe and compromise this race, then essentially everything, my whole body of work would be compromised because you could make an argument. Right.
Rare individual, like you said, you know, not only his integrity, but his ability also, you know, no matter what the count was, whether it's his count or official count of races won, you know, 34% winning percentage, 3 Kentucky Derbies, won the Derby, the Oaks, and the Clark Handicap all in the same year, which is pretty, you know, I don't know that any modern jockey has done that I can think of.
And just think about it, the Clark Handicap, some of the races that are still run today, you know, I mean, he won that 4 times, you know, 1879, 84, 85, 1890.
Isaac is indeed, to this day, the only jockey to win the Kentucky Derby, Kentucky Oaks, and Clark Handicap all in the same year. A record, one could say, of DiMaggio-like proportion that may never be equaled. Isaac was at the height of his powers when the match race between Salvatore and Tenney was held on June 25, 1890, at the now long-gone Sheepshead Bay racetrack. For those of you interested, the Sheepshead Bay Oval was located in an area now that is just north of where the Shore Parkway turns into the Belt Parkway in the Coney Island section of Brooklyn. On that day, not only was Isaac opposed by rival jockey Ed Snapper Garrison, he had another foe looming on the horizon that would prove far more difficult, ultimately, to overcome.
You know, just diving into Isaac's story a little bit prior to that, this was really when Isaac was on his just hot streak, just winning everything. Mm-hmm. But it also coincides with, you see, the fervor of race relations ramping up. So I always try to tell people and temper it a little bit where you can see Isaac, I think, being the dominant sports figure of the day, was really trying to outride what I always say Jim Crow ideology by proving, you know, just black excellence, if you will, and thinking, and it appears based on all the literature and his autobiography, that as the more that starts to infiltrate thoroughbred racing, the greater his winning percentages start to take off. So 1890 is a very pivotal year in that whole storyline because he first wins the Suburban Handicap. Then he goes on in the month of May he wins with Salvatore, obviously. And then that race, he won, Ed Snapper Garrison finishes second. But the previous year, if you go back and look at it, 1889, Ed Snapper Garrison wins the Suburban Handicap. So and these two were equal talents. I mean, career-wise, you know, these guys were the best of the best in their fields. They had a mutual respect for one another. I think if you look at the career stats, Isaac, who wins over 640 races by his own account, confirmed that's around 500-something races. I think Snapper Garrison, in totality, wins 700 races. So based on career races, they were right there. Isaac had a shorter lifespan, but it was just, again, just a fascinating buildup to what wound up being match of the century.
By the way, if you've ever heard the term Garrison finish relating to a furious race-ending charge from far back, well, now you've been introduced to the man whose riding style gave birth to that now familiar phrase in our sporting lexicon. This wasn't just a match race between two champion horses by the names of Salvatore and Tenney. There was the match race between jockeys as well, and owners, with those wider Jim Crow overtones lurking over the proceedings. It was Salvatore's defeat with Isaac up of Tenney in the Suburban Handicap, also held at Sheepshead Bay Racetrack, that set the stage for the June 25th contest.
Going into after the Suburban Handicaps, and Isaac comes out victorious, I think that really set the tone because at that time, you know, this whole ideology around race and superiority and had already infiltrated the racing establishment. So what you see is you see Isaac winning that race. It really, it set off Tenney's owner, you know, and that was T. Pulsifer. I might be mispronouncing his name.
Yeah.
But he was so, what's the word? Enraged that Isaac won that race, that obviously he challenges his horse, Tenney and Salvador, to a match race. And, obviously Salvador, you know, that he was owned by Ben Ali Hagen.
Mm-hmm. Right. A name familiar to Keeneland, attendees, right,
exactly. You know, so you see, you know, and of course he made his money out in California in the California Gold Rush, and
yep.
I think if I'm not mistaken, he owned at one point the largest horse racing and breeding operation in the world, out in Sacramento, near Sacramento, California, Rancho De Paso. So there that whole rivalry, and of course it goes to New York because at that time, you know, all of the wealthy owners who made their money in land ownership, and you know, these guys would go to New York for staging all the big races, and then that sets the stage for the June 25th match of the century, 1890. You know, in the press, it was, you know, billed as Black versus White. Just fascinating storylines within this particular race.
In large part due to the racial elements fanned into flames by the press, in part due to the enmity between the two camps that was also racially driven, and in some part just due to the love of a good old match race, back in the day when proving your horse was faster than another horse carried a lot of weight and bragging rights, anticipation of the event did run rampant amongst the general public. So rampant, in fact, that the poet Elsa Wheeler Wilcox, frequently cited in the annals of bad poetry as one of its foremost practitioners, penned an ode to the race that, to these untrained plebeian ears at least, has merit in terms of meter and rhyming, even if it is quite unlikely Isaac ever pondered the race in such flowery terms. The gate was thrown open, I rode out alone, more proud than a monarch who sits on a throne. I am but a jockey, yet shout upon shout went up from the people who watched me ride out. And the cheers that rang forth from that warm-hearted crowd were as earnest as those to which monarch e'er bowed. My heart thrilled with pleasure so keen it was pain as I patted my Salvator's soft silken mane, and a sweet shiver shot from his hide to my hand as we passed by the multitude down to the stand. The great waves of cheering came billowing back as the hoofs of brave Tenney rang swift down the track, and he stood there beside us, all bone and all muscle, our noble opponent well trained for the tussle. They waited us there on the smooth shining course, my Salvator fair to the lovers of horse. As a beautiful woman is fair to man's sight, pure type of the thoroughbred, clean limbed and bright, stood taking the plaudits as only his due, and nothing at all unexpected or new. And then there before us the bright flag is spread, there's a roar from the grandstand and Tenney's ahead. At the sound of the voices that shouted, a go, he sprang like an arrow shot straight from the bow. I tighten the reins on Prince Charlie's great son. He is off like a rocket. The race is begun. Halfway down the furlong, their heads are together, scarce room twixt their noses to wedge in a feather. Past grandstand and judges in neck-to-neck strife, ah, Salvator, boy, 'tis the race of your life. I press my knees closer. I coax him, I urge. I feel him go out with a leap and a surge. I see him creep on, inch by inch, stride by stride, while backward, still backward, falls Tenney beside. We are nearing the turn, the first quarter is past. Twixt leader and chaser, the daylight is cast. The distance elongates, still Tenney sweeps on, as grateful and free-limbed and swift as a fawn. His awkwardness vanished, his muscles all strained. A noble opponent, well-born and well-trained. I glanced on my shoulder, ha, Tenney the cost of that 1 second's flagging will be the race lost. 1 second's weak yielding of courage and strength, and the daylight between us has doubled its length. The race is hardly over, nor is our story. More poetry, more on the match race, and more with Leon and Calvin next time on Can Do. In the meantime, may good health, happiness, and gratitude for both be with you and your loved ones, always.
I got the horse.